experience as much as were the men and women in the Aeneid or King Lear or Pride and Prejudice. How do you handle bad times, even tragedy? Take Back the Night could not have been conceived without the feminist movement. And feminism, in the form of some of its notable texts, had itself become part of the great books. I had wanted these texts to answer some of the silences in the Western canon about women, and they had. But a few weeks after Take Back the Night, as we started reading Beauvoir, I kept wondering how a movement that had wanted to bring full selfhood to women could, among its many manifestations, possibly issue in such an event as Take Back the Night. How many rapes had actually taken place on the Columbia Barnard campus? Only a few were reported. Of course, women don't easily bring charges to make complaints against men they know. So the question of how many might never receive an accurate answer. In any case, the evening was not confined to Columbia experience. A woman is under siege always. That was the point. And the stories continued for a long, long time, well into the morning hours, woman after woman, some of them clearly describing their experience for the second or third year in a row. They were a community of witness and confession, a community of survivors. Many wept at the microphone, getting through their stories only after repeated encouragement from the audience. It's not our fault. It's not our fault, the audience chanted, and there were cheers and shouts of reassurance. A man listening to such stories is like a woman overhearing tales of combat. The narratives are spectacular, mesmerizing, but distant and sometimes opaque. Outside of prison, few men are raped. As one of the protected sex, I saw that, for these women at least, the bitterest part of rape was not the experience of being overpowered and invaded against their will, awful as that was. The bitterest part was betrayal. But that wasn't all of it. I heard different kinds of misery that night. Some of the stories were not quite about rape. A fair number, perhaps about a third, followed a pattern rather like this. I went out with this guy. He seemed really nice. We went to his room, or my room, and had a few drinks and listened to music. We were kissing and fooling around, lying in bed together. But then I said no, and he continued, and I said no, and then he raped me. And now I am full of rage and shame, and I will never trust anyone again. Having been back to Take Back the Night a second time a year later, I've now heard many variations on this basic story, the date rape story, the campus story. And I had the same response to it that renegade feminists Camille Paglia and Katie Roif have described in their books. Disbelief and ridicule, exasperation, and finally despair. As every feminist said, the right to say no was unassailable. No was no, and not try again in a few minutes. But I could not understand why women should not take some responsibility, some command and control over the many stages of the evening up to the point of no. Responsibility and freedom were at the very heart of feminism. That's what women had taught me. For the women of my generation, women in their 40s and 50s, the right to say no had become unassailable and unequivocal. But they had fought as well for the right to say yes. They had struggled for a freer sexual life. They would choose as well as reject their partners. They would sleep with someone without suffering the scorn of their parents and friends. Their revolution had been only a partial success. At times, men exploited women's right to say yes, and women felt used. But women had ended, for good, one had thought, the old division of the female sex into virgin and whore. The two rights, yes and no, were now equal in importance and absolutely complementary. Woven together, a fabric of acceptance and rejection, attraction and indifference, they constituted the strength of sexual temperament, the taste, the living character, the mystery of a woman in her romantic life. Isn't that what everyone but reactionaries believes? But at Take Back the Night, not a single woman in my hearing said that her right to pleasure and even love would not be compromised by the betrayal of men. By implication, all women were in the rape community. All women were damaged. One of the campus groups, the Rape Crisis Center Coalition, began referring a year later to potential survivors. Were the college women literally under threat? Perhaps they exaggerated, but then my fear of crime was subjective too. You internalize a rational or half-rational fear, and it eats away at your soul. You become less free. You cut yourself off from experience. But then you had to fight back. Sophocles and Shakespeare stirred uneasily. The purpose of education, after all, was not just to impart knowledge and modes of thinking, but to train character, which meant, in the end, the character to handle difficult, even catastrophic experience. Not to accept it, but to handle it. To be equal to it. So, with the books in my head, I was half sympathetic to what I heard, half not. Sympathetic to the experience of fear, but not to the yielding of self to fear. Certainly, confusion and defeat hung in the air at Take Back the Night. As Royf and Paglia said, some of the women were denying that they were sexual beings at all. They were turning back the clock to the 1950s or earlier, when man was always the insensate, lustful beast and woman the delicate flower. They were embracing the embarrassing rubbish of hypocritical ages past, when mendacity ruled sexual manners and women were not considered responsible for their own desires or even willing to acknowledge that they had any. Rape cannot be imagined as a positive experience, but it should not be imagined as all of experience. The rest of life cried out, if not that night, then in the following weeks, when I beseeched the great books, in my mind at least, to heal the wounds, and I wondered, in classroom discussions, what it was that male and female students wanted from one another. This public disgust, this anguish, what could a woman build on it except separatism and gender chauvinism and rage that fed on itself and justified itself? What could it produce in men, even in innocent men, especially in innocent men, but caution, guilt, and resentment? Were all relations between the sexes to be conducted, so to speak, under the curse of rape? I was amazed, and at times I felt like someone's free-thinking bachelor uncle. What about flirtation and romance? What about sex? Would no one say a word in praise of lust? The Second Sex was issued in France in 1949 and in America in 1953, and somehow I had never looked into it. When I became aware of the book in the 60s, I was preoccupied with the Vietnam War, and I thought, oh, yes, the women's issue. It wasn't important to me. And in the early 70s, when American and English feminists like Kate Millett and Germaine Greer published their famous books, respectively, Sexual Politics and The Female Eunuch, I assumed that they had gone beyond Beauvoir. And so I read their books, Millett, grindingly doctrinaire, Greer, funny and loose-limbed, and continued to ignore Beauvoir. Stephenson, starting with a bang, called it the single most important feminist text of the century. And, as if answering the old dismissal of Beauvoir as some sort of opportunistic hanger-on, he warned us against the common error of looking at the Second Sex as a mere extension of Sartre's early existentialism. Actually, he said, Simone de Beauvoir may have accomplished more in philosophy than Sartre. Simone de Beauvoir formulated the secondary nature of women's reality in philosophical terms. and even though her analysis is now familiar, partly from all the writers who have stolen from it, some with scant acknowledgement, the words still have the power to startle. The book was written almost 50 years ago. Being a man in our culture, she says, is central. Maleness simply defines, bestrides, reality. The human response, as such, is male. In the midst of an abstract discussion, it is vexing to hear a man say, "You think thus and so because you are a woman." But I know that my only defense is to reply, "I think thus and so because it is true," thereby removing my subjective self from the argument. It would be out of the question to reply, "And you think the contrary because you are a man." For it is understood that the fact of being a man is no peculiarity. A man is in the right in being a man. It is the woman who is in the wrong. It amounts to this. Just as for the ancients there was an absolute vertical with reference to which the oblique was defined, so there is an absolute human type, the masculine. Woman has ovaries, a uterus. These peculiarities imprison her in her subjectivity, circumscribe her within the limits of her own nature. It is often said that she thinks with her glands. Man superbly ignores the fact that his anatomy also includes glands, such as the testicles, and that they secrete hormones. He thinks of his body as a direct and normal connection with the world, which he believes he apprehends objectively, whereas he regards the body of woman as a hindrance, a prison, weighed down by everything peculiar to it. The second sex has a strong, steady intellectual flavor, and was written in a better and freer temper than many later feminist books. Millett, Greer, and others are now falling into the background, a cruel remark perhaps, but irrefutable. Beauvoir remains more intelligent and comprehensive than her imitators, and part of her intelligence is to create a picture of life that men, as well as women, can recognize as true. She did not simply write of women as victims. She wrote of life as defined by the patriarchal system, of men and women living together under such a system. Men had also been shaped by the dialectic of sex. It was something they were doing to themselves as well as to women. Wide experience, wide sympathies, an absence of rancor or special pleading. The Second Sex is a book with a generous conception of life behind it. She avoids the abrupt and schematic resentments, the unmodulated rejections of the radical American feminists who followed and were influenced by her. She insists that whatever the injustices of woman's existence, life is a common enterprise. In the immense chapter Dreams, Fears, Idols, as Beauvoir describes the many ways men had constructed female identity for their own use, she brings an almost poetic richness to the elaboration of male folly. Men have largely, until recently, controlled representation. Since women did not make myths of their own behavior, Beauvoir says, these male illusions, dreams, and fears were part of the way men controlled women. A clear injustice, but what a garden of wonders. As Beauvoir describes it, the fecundity of male fantasy throughout history became marvelous without ceasing to be absurd and sinister. There was a deep ambiguity in her evocations of the patriarchy that I found fascinating and moving. Some of the ways men had imprisoned women were touched by grace or comfort, and some of women's responses were touched by sublimity. Here on earth, men are defenders of the law of reason, of necessity. Woman is aware of the original contingency of man himself, and of this necessity in which he believes. Hence come both the mysterious irony that flits across her lips and her pliant generosity. She heals the wounds of the males. She nurses the newborn, and she lays out the dead. She knows everything about man that attacks his pride and humiliates his self-will. While she inclines before him and humbles the flesh to the spirit. She stays on the fleshly frontiers of the spirit, softening, as I have said, the hard angles of man's constructions, and bestowing upon them unforeseen luxury and grace. Woman's power over men comes from the fact that she gently recalls them to a modest realization of their true condition. It is the secret of her disillusioned, sorrowful, ironical, and loving wisdom. In women, even frivolity, capriciousness, and ignorance are charming virtues because they flourish this side of and beyond the world where man chooses to live, but where he does not like to feel himself confined. Over against set meanings and tools made for useful purposes, she upholds the mystery of intact things. She wafts the breath of poetry through city streets, over cultivated fields. Much of this has retreated into the past. Women have fought for and gained a degree of economic independence, and in Beauvoir's terms, woman, at least in the more successful classes of the advanced industrial countries, is now both subject and object, the one and the other, worker and companion, professional and mother. Absolved of her magical and mythical functions, literally disenchanted, she is no longer required to bless the fields and dispense balm on all male occasions. The Beauvoir excerpts were well received in class, but after Stevenson led us through a quick exposition of Beauvoir's central ideas, the conversation grew testy. The implacable Manuel weighed in. "Here again," he rumbled. "I'm going to take the radical conservative standpoint." Sighs from both men and women. "Most feminists are clueless as to what the society would look like if they were actually empowered. Women want equal wages, control of reproductive rights. But these are only part of the benefits of power. I don't see women wanting the right to kill or the right to exploit. Men have developed over the generations the paradoxical notion that power is not a good thing. It's someone has to have it. But women don't want that kind of power." Earlier in the year, the students had been deferential to Manuel, unwilling to argue with a blind man, but no more. Hands went up furiously. He seemed to be taunting women to put up or shut up, take power and accept the consequences of power, or stop talking about it. Manuel was also raising the old question of what women want, what women are. That is, do women have an inherent nature, in this case one that is unwilling to wield power in its fiercest aspect, or is that nature defined by their political situation in a male-dominated society? Are there any temperamental differences between the sexes? That old question, and it never goes away. We were at the end, and literature was hanging in the balance. It was time to make a reckoning. "Who here comes from a savage race?" the coach shouted at his students. "We all come from Africa," said one African-American in the class, Henry, calmly referring to the supposition among many anthropologists that human life originated in sub-Saharan Africa. In other words, there are no racial hierarchies among peoples. We're all savages. Shapiro smiled. It was not, I thought, exactly the answer he was looking for, but it was a good answer. Then he was off again. "Are you natural?" he roared at a woman sitting quietly near him at the end of the table. "What are the constraints for you? What are the rivets? Why are you here getting civilized, reading Lit Hum?" At the end of the year's work in Lit Hum, the mood had grown agitated, burdened, portentous. In short, we were reading Joseph Conrad. At the conclusion of Lit Hum, individual instructors are allotted a week for a free choice. Some teachers chose works by Dostoevsky or Mann or Gide or Borges. Professor Shapiro, who enjoyed trouble, had chosen Conrad. The terms of his rhetorical questions, savagery, civilization, restraint, rivets, were drawn from Conrad's great novella of colonial depredation, Heart of Darkness. And the students were electrified. Almost 100 years old, and familiar to generations of readers, Conrad's little book has lost none of its power to amaze and appall. It remains in many places an essential starting point for discussion of modernism, imperialism, the hypocrisies of the West, the ambiguities of civilization. Infinitely complex, it has been subjected over the years to symbolic, mythological, and psychoanalytic interpretations. T.S. Eliot put a quotation from it at the head of his poem, The Hollow Men. Hemingway and Faulkner were much impressed by it, as were Orson Welles, who had wanted to make a movie of it, and Francis Ford Coppola, who employed it as the ground plan for his despairing epic of Americans in Vietnam, Apocalypse Now. In recent years, however, Conrad, and particularly Heart of Darkness, had fallen under a cloud of suspicion in the Academy. In the curious language of the tribe, the book has become a site of contestation. After all, Conrad offered a 19th-century European's view of Africans as primitive. He attacked Belgian imperialism and in the same breath praised the British variety. In 1975, the distinguished Nigerian novelist and essayist Chinua Achebe attacked Heart of Darkness as racist and called for its elimination from the canon of Western classics. And recently, Edward W. Said, Columbia's most famous living critic and literary scholar, had been raising hostile and undermining questions about it. Said gathered the material together along with a great deal else in his 1993 book, Culture and Imperialism. Said certainly was no breaker of canons, but he put the book on the defensive. And if Conrad were somehow discredited, it would be hard to imagine a more successful challenge to what the academic left has repeatedly deplored as the hegemonic discourse of the classic Western texts. Written in a little more than 2 months, the last of 1898, and the first of 1899, Heart of Darkness is both the story of a journey and a kind of morbid fairy tale. Marlowe, Conrad's narrator and familiar alter ego, a British merchant seaman of the 1890s, travels up the Congo River in the service of a rapacious Belgian trading company, hoping to retrieve the company's brilliant representative and ivory trader, Mr. Kurtz, who has mysteriously grown silent. The great Mr. Kurtz. In Africa, everyone gossips about him, envies him, and, with rare exception, loathes him. The flower of European civilization, all Europe contributed to the making of Kurtz. Exemplar of light and compassion, journalist, artist, humanist, Kurtz has gone way upriver and at times well into the jungle, abandoning himself to certain practices. Rifle in hand, he has set himself up as god or devil in ascendancy over the Africans. Conrad is notoriously vague about what Kurtz actually does. But if you said, kill some people, has sex with others, steals all the ivory, you would not, I believe, be far wrong. In Kurtz, the alleged benevolence of colonialism has monstrously flowered into criminality. Marlowe's voyage from Europe to Africa and then upriver to Kurtz's inner station is a revelation of the squalors and disasters of the colonial mission. It is also, in Marlowe's mind, a journey back to the beginning of creation, when nature reigned exuberant and unrestrained, and a trip figuratively down as well, through the levels of the self to repressed and unlawful desires, no longer overlaid or muffled by social existence. At death's door, Marlowe and Kurtz find each other. Rereading is often a shock, an encounter with an earlier self that has been revised, and I discovered that I was initially discomforted, as I had not been in the past, by the famous manner, the magnificent, alarmed, and there's no other word, throbbing excitement of Conrad's laboriously mastered English. Conrad was born in Tsarist-occupied Poland. Though he heard English spoken as a boy, his father translated Shakespeare, English was his third language, and his prose now and then betrays the propensity for high intellectual melodrama and euphonious and rhymed abstraction, characteristic of his second, French. Oh, inexorable, unutterable, unspeakable. Conrad's adjectives were notorious. Going up that river was like traveling back to the earliest beginnings of the world when vegetation rioted on the earth and the big trees were kings. An empty stream, a great silence, an impenetrable forest. The air was warm, thick, heavy, sluggish. There was no joy in the brilliance of sunshine. The long stretches of the waterway ran on, deserted, into the gloom of overshadowed distances. On silvery sandbanks, hippos and alligators sunned themselves side by side. The broadening waters flowed through a mob of wooded islands. You lost your way on that river as you would in a desert and butted all day long against shoals trying to find the channel till you thought yourself bewitched and cut off forever from everything you had known once, somewhere, far away, in another existence, perhaps. There were moments when one's past came back to one, as it will sometimes when you've not a moment to spare to yourself. But it came in the shape of an unrestful and noisy dream, remembered with wonder amongst the overwhelming realities of this strange world of plants and water and silence. And this stillness of life did not in the least resemble a peace. It was the stillness of an implacable force brooding over an inscrutable intention. In one sense, the writing now seemed close to the movies. It reveled in sensation, in extreme acts and grotesque violence, however indirectly presented. In shivering enigmas and richly phrased premonitions and frights. In other ways, though, Heart of Darkness was modernism at its most intellectually bracing, with tonalities entirely contemporary and distant that I had also failed to notice when I was younger. Immense pride and immense contempt. A mood of barely contained revolt and sardonic humor approaching malevolence. I don't pretend to say that steamboat floated all the time. More than once she had to wade for a bit, with 20 cannibals splashing around and pushing. We had enlisted some of these chaps on the way for a crew. Fine fellows, cannibals, in their place. They were men one could work with, and I am grateful to them. And after all, they did not eat each other before my face. They had brought along a provision of hippo meat which went rotten and made the mystery of the wilderness stink in my nostrils. Phew! I can sniff it now. I had the manager on board and three or four pilgrims, i.e. white traders, with their staves all complete. Sometimes we came upon a station close by the bank, clinging to the skirts of the unknown, and the white men rushing out of a tumble-down hovel with great gestures of joy and surprise and welcome seemed very strange, had the appearance of being held there captive by a spell. The word ivory would ring in the air for a while, and on we went again into the silence, along empty reaches, round the still bends, between the high walls of our winding way, reverberating in hollow claps, the ponderous beat of the stern wheel. Out of sight of their countrymen back home, who continue to cloak the colonial mission in the language of Christian charity and improvement, the pilgrims have become rapacious and cruel. The cannibals eating hippo meat practice restraint. The Europeans do not. That was the point of Shapiro's taunting initial sally. Savagery was inherent in all of us, including the most civilized, for we lived, according to Conrad, in a brief interlude between innumerable centuries of darkness and the darkness yet to come. Only the rivets, desperately needed to repair Marlowe's pathetic steamboat, offer security and stability. The rivets and the ship itself, and the codes of seamanship and duty, all holding life together in a time of moral anarchy. Marlowe, meeting Kurtz at last, despises him for letting go, and at the same time, with breathtaking ambivalence admires him for going all the way to the bottom of his soul and discovering there, at the point of death, a judgment of his own life. This is perhaps the most famous death scene written after Shakespeare. Anything approaching the change that came over his features I have never seen before, and hope never to see again. Oh, I wasn't touched. I was fascinated. It was as though a veil had been rent. I saw in that ivory face the expression of somber pride, of ruthless power, of craven terror, of an intense and hopeless despair. Did he live his life again in every detail of desire, temptation, and surrender during that supreme moment of complete knowledge? He cried in a whisper at some image, at some vision. He cried out twice, a cry that was no more than a breath. Much dispute and occasional merriment have long attended the question of what exactly Kurtz means by the Victorian exclamation, "the horror." But surely one of the things he means is his long reveling in abominations. What he has done, the giving way, the internal collapse. "The book is a kind of test," said Joseph, the mild and polite Joseph, who now developed Christine's line. "Does its existence redeem the male hegemonic line of culture? Does it redeem education in this tradition?" By which I believe that Joseph meant to ask, could the existence of such a book redeem the crimes of imperialism? That, at least, was my question. Shapiro's students were bolder and freer than they had been all year long, and as the class went on, they expounded points in the text, some of them holding the little paperbacks in their hands like preachers before the faithful. Over and over, Shapiro had struggled to get them to read aloud, and with some emotional commitment to the words, and all too often they had droned, as if reading a technical manual. But now they read aloud spontaneously, and their voices were up, excited, even ringing. They were becoming readers. "Well, this course, it's a kind of summing up, isn't it?" Shapiro said. "We began with the journey to Troy." "It has a resemblance to all the journeys through hell we've read," said Alex, who had been scornful and then intelligent about Jane Austen. And Alex cited the voyages to the underworld and the Odyssey and the Aeneid. And he mentioned Dante, whom Conrad, in one of his greatest moments, obviously had in mind. Marlowe arrives at the trading company's central station, a disastrous, ramshackle settlement of wrecked machinery and rusting nails, and there encounters under the trees dozens of exhausted African workers who have been left to die. "It seemed to me I had stepped into the gloomy circle of some inferno," he says. "They were dying slowly, it was very clear. They were not enemies, they were not criminals, they were nothing earthly now, nothing but black shadows of disease and starvation lying confusedly in the greenish gloom, brought from all the recesses of the coast in all the legality of time contracts, lost in uncongenial surroundings, fed on unfamiliar food, they sickened, became inefficient, and were then allowed to crawl away and rest. These moribund shapes were free as air and nearly as thin. I began to distinguish the gleam of the eyes under the trees. Then glancing down, I saw a face near my hand. The black bones reclined at full length with one shoulder against the tree, and slowly the eyelids rose and the sunken eyes looked up at me, enormous and vacant, a kind of blind white flicker in the depths of the orbs which died out slowly. The man seemed young, almost a boy, but you know with them it's hard to tell. I found nothing else to do but offer him one of my good Swedes ship's biscuits I had in my pocket. The fingers closed slowly on it and held. There was no other movement and no other glance. Near the same tree, two more bundles of acute angles sat with their legs drawn up, one with his chin propped on his knees, stared at nothing in an intolerable and appalling manner. His brother phantom rested its forehead as if overcome with a great weariness. and all about others were scattered in every pose of contorted collapse, as in some picture of a massacre or a pestilence. Despite the final clauses which link the Grove of Death to ancient and medieval catastrophes, there is a sense here, as many readers have said, of something unprecedented in horror, something new on Earth, what later became known as genocide. Marlowe shocked the sheer strangeness of the ravaged human forms, anticipates what the Allied liberators of the concentration camps felt in 1945. The answer to the question, does the book redeem the West, could only be provisional, since no book can do that for any culture. But if some crimes are irredeemable, frank acknowledgement of crime might lead to a partial remission of sin. Conrad had written such an acknowledgement. As Heart of Darkness, a depraved book, the following is one of the passages Chinua Achebe deplores as racist. We were wanderers on a prehistoric earth, on an earth that wore the aspect of an unknown planet. We could have fancied ourselves the first of men taking possession of an accursed inheritance to be subdued at the cost of profound anguish and of excessive toil. But suddenly, as we struggled round a bend, there would be a glimpse of rush walls, of peaked grass roofs, a burst of yells, a whirl of black limbs, a mass of hands clapping, of feet stamping, of bodies swaying, of eyes rolling under the droop of heavy and motionless foliage. The steamer toiled along, slowly on the edge of a black and incomprehensible frenzy. The prehistoric man was cursing us, praying to us, welcoming us, who could tell? We were cut off from the comprehension of our surroundings. We glided past like phantoms, wondering and secretly appalled, as sane men would be before an enthusiastic outbreak in a madhouse. We could not understand because we were too far, and could not remember because we were traveling in the night of first ages, of those ages that are gone, leaving hardly a sign and no memories. The earth seemed unearthly. We are accustomed to look upon the shackled form of a conquered monster, but there you could look at a thing monstrous and free. It was unearthly. And the men were... No, they were not inhuman. Well, you know, that was the worst of it. This suspicion of their not being inhuman. It would come slowly to one. They howled and leaped and spun and made horrid faces. But what thrilled you was just the thought of their humanity, like yours. The thought of your remote kinship with this wild and passionate uproar. Ugly. Yes, it was ugly enough. But if you were man enough, you would admit to yourself that there was in you just the faintest trace of a response to the terrible frankness of that noise. A dim suspicion of there being a meaning in it which you so remote from the night of first ages, could comprehend. Achebe believes that Heart of Darkness is an example of the European habit of setting up Africa as a foil to Europe, a place of negations, in comparison with which Europe's own state of spiritual grace will be manifest. Conrad, obsessed with the black skin of Africans, had as his real purpose the desire to comfort Europeans in their sense of superiority. Heart of Darkness projects the image of Africa as the other world, the antithesis of Europe and therefore of civilization, a place where man's vaunted intelligence and refinement are finally mocked by triumphant bestiality. Achebe dismissed the Grove of Death passage and others like it as bleeding heart sentiments, mere decoration in a book that parades in the most vulgar fashion prejudices and insults from which a section of mankind has suffered untold agonies and atrocities in the past and continues to do so in many ways in many places today. I am talking about a story in which the very humanity of black people is called in question. Chinua Achebe has written at least one great novel, Things Fall Apart, a book I love and from which I have learned a great deal. At this article on Conrad, originally a speech delivered at the University of Massachusetts in 1975 and revised for the third Norton edition of the novel in 1987 and reprinted as well in Achebe's 1988 collection of essays, Hopes and Impediments, is an act of rhetorical violence, and I recoiled from it. I wanted to argue that most of the students with whom I had just read the book, not Europeans, but an American elite, had seen Heart of Darkness as a representation of the West's infamy, and hardly as an affirmation of its spiritual grace. And I would insist that everything in Heart of Darkness, not just the spectacular frights of the African jungle, but everything, including the city of Brussels and Marlowe's perception of every white character, is rendered sardonically and nightmarishly as an experience of estrangement and displacement. Yes, Conrad describes the Africans gesticulating on the riverbank as a violently incomprehensible other. But consider the fictional situation. Having arrived fresh from Europe, Marlowe, surrounded by jungle, commands a small steamer traveling up the big river en route to an unknown destiny, death perhaps. He is a character in an adventure story, baffled by strangeness. Heart of Darkness could indeed be read as racist by anyone sufficiently angry to ignore its fictional strategies, its palpable anguish, and the many differences between Conrad's 1890s consciousness of race and our own. It could be read as racist by anyone ruthless enough to detach its representation of life from meaning. As philosopher Richard Rorty recently complained, professors of cultural studies teach students to brush past heart-stopping poetry to seek out conditions of cultural production. Such readings are all part of the movement to disenchant reading. The old way of reading fiction for pleasure, my falling once again under Conrad's spell, has been declared naive and possibly reactionary, a submission to political values whose nature is disguised precisely by the pleasures of the narrative. In some quarters, pleasure in reading has itself become a political error, rather like sex in Orwell's 1984. Why am I so angry? A disagreeable essay or book does not spell the end of Western civilization, and liberal humanists of all people should be able to listen to points of view contrary to their own. Of course, if literature were in a state of exuberant health, one might shrug off such bizarre readings. One might accept the anger directed at works of art as a passing academic fashion, an outbreak of conference hall daring soon to fade away. But in a period in which literature threatens to disappear into cyberspace, or simply get pushed to the side by the omnivorousness of pop culture, the universities pretty much dominate the show. For better or worse, the future of literacy belongs to the professors. And in recent years, parts of the academic left, eager to restore the unheard voices of the past, have begun discrediting the heard voices of the past. Conrad's precarious situation, both inside and outside imperialism, both inside and outside racial consciousness, should be seen not as a weakness, but as a strength. This writer had done his time as a colonial employee, working for a Belgian company in 1890, making his own trip up the River Congo. He had lived within the framework of colonial expansion. If he had not, could he have written anything like Heart of Darkness? Could he have captured with such devastating force the peculiar hollow triviality of the colonists' ambitions, the self-seeking, the greed, the pettiness, the lies and evasions? The ambivalence of Conrad is precisely his glory. Here was the last great Victorian, insisting on responsibility and order, and fighting at the same time an exhausting struggle against uncertainty and doubt, such that he cast every truth in his fictions as a mocking illusion and turned what could have been a simple, morally didactic adventure tale into an endlessly provocative battle between stoical assumption of duty and perverse complicity in evil. Conrad Sea Captain Marlowe loathes the monstrous Kurtz. It feels after Kurtz's death an overpowering loyalty to the integrity of what Kurtz discovered in his descent into crime. I have wrestled with death. It is the most unexciting contest you can imagine. It takes place in an impalpable grayness, with nothing underfoot, with nothing around, without spectators, without clamor, without glory, without the great desire of victory, without the great fear of defeat, in a sickly atmosphere of tepid skepticism, without much belief in your own right, and still less in that of your adversary. If such is the form of ultimate wisdom, then life is a greater riddle than some of us think it to be. I was within a hair's breadth of the last opportunity for pronouncement, and I found with humiliation that probably I would have nothing to say. This is the reason why I affirm that Kurtz was a remarkable man. He had something to say. He said it. He had summed up. He had judged. The horror. He was a remarkable man. After all, this was the expression of some sort of belief. It had candor. It had conviction. It had a vibrating note of revolt in its whisper. It had the appalling face of a glimpsed truth. The strange commingling of desire and hate. It was an affirmation, a moral victory, paid for by innumerable defeats, by abominable terrors, by abominable satisfactions. But it was a victory. That is why I have remained loyal to Kurtz to the last. The horror was nothing less than Conrad's burden as artist and man, the violent contraries that possessed him. T.S. Eliot and others understood Heart of Darkness to be a new kind of art, an art that pulled together the radically disjunctive experiences of the age, utmost violence and utmost spiritual longing, into ever more complex aesthetic forms. The great achievement of modernism was its union of the discordant and the metaphysical. Seen in that light, the daunting intricacy of Conrad's work is unimaginable without his participation in imperialism. The students seem to understand that. The intensity of their response, even their way of reading aloud, suggested they knew that Heart of Darkness was something special, a work of art that was thrilling and subversive at the same time. In this class, liberal humanism had resisted and survived, though the experience had left us all a little shaken. It was hard these days, as Shapiro said, to find yourself. I don't want to say that this is a work that teaches desperation, he had said at the beginning of the class, or that the evil is something we can't deal with. In some ways, the world we live in is not as dark as Conrad's. In some ways, darker. This is not a one-way slide to the apocalypse that we are witnessing. We ourselves have the ability now to recognize and even to fix and change our society, even as literature reflects, embodies, and serves as an agent of change. The students were relieved. They wanted reconciliation and peace. And one of them, it seems, had, like Marlowe, arrived at the end of his journey. We scream at the wilderness, Henry said, concluding his presentation with a flourish. And the wilderness screams back. There's a tension. And at that point of tension, we resolve our nature. Spring had burst Columbia's gray cement and stone, and the windows in Hamilton were raised high. The sound of birds, birds, penetrated the New York roar. We were reading Virginia Woolf as the last assigned text. Shapiro read Conrad after Woolf as a free choice in his final week. The author of To the Lighthouse and Mrs. Dalloway had not been on the list when I took Lit Hum in 1961, but recently in a fit of tardy reform, spurred in part by women joining the college, the teaching staff had added Wolf and dropped Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. Once again, it's silly to make too much of these substitutions in an arbitrary selection of masterpieces, and just as silly to pretend that one is indifferent to the changes. A large shift in taste had touched Columbia's core curriculum. Dostoevsky, of course, would survive, but something had been added to literature, something added to sensibility. When I first read Wolf as a junior, stumbling through To the Lighthouse in an English novel survey course taken 2 years after Lit Hum, I had registered very little. A cloud, swellingly gracious, noble, beautiful, but shapeless, even amorphous. That's all I can bring back, and I had largely stayed away from Wolf ever since. I had been sure she wasn't worth the trouble. But now as I went through To the Lighthouse again, I was stunned by Virginia Woolf's prose. I could not read those tender, pressing, inward-driving sentences without stopping, reading again, and letting the words and rhythm sink in. Unable at the beginning of the year to remember Homer, unable to find myself, stumbling over empty memories and the vanished boundary between the reader sitting at home and the media engulfing everything, I had by degrees recovered one thing and then another, and now I had more memories than I knew what to do with. And the oddity of it was that the most abundant flood was produced by a writer who had never meant a thing to me. There was, for